You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We just heard in that report from NPR that at least 41 people were killed and 140 wounded earlier today when a suicide bomber drove a car loaded with explosives into the Indian embassy in Kabul, the Afghan capital. Violence has risen in Afghanistan over the past couple of months, in line with a promise made by Taliban fighters earlier this year to increase attacks on foreigners in the country. The New York Times reported last week that more American and coalition soldiers in Afghanistan died in June than in any other month since the invasion began. Former NPR reporter Sarah Chase has been living in the southern city of Kandahar for over 6 years now, and we've been checking in with her from time to time for updates on the situation there. She is the author of The Punishment of Virtue, Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban. I'm very pleased to welcome her back to the show. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, it's great to be back with you.
I'm sure you are stunned by this latest news, but the last time you spoke with us, you said you didn't think the Taliban would regain full control in Afghanistan. Haven't they been making a serious comeback, and isn't this another example of that?
Yeah, I mean, what I still doubt is going to happen is that you'll see a new Taliban government of all of Afghanistan, and I hold to that. That being said, the developments that we're witnessing now, I've been predicting them for months, if not years. I mean, this really does not come as a surprise. If anything, I'm a little bit surprised at how sort of patient and methodical it's been. Sometimes I expected it to happen faster.
Well, hasn't the upsurge been concentrated largely in the southern and eastern parts of the country? That's because the American and British forces have been fighting them there, but this is also where you are living, isn't it?
Yeah, and I actually don't think it's because of I don't think it's a case of U.S. and NATO forces serving as a kind of lightning rod, if that's what you're implying. Kandahar, which is where I live, it's a really, really symbolic city. We have a tendency to think of things really in institutional terms, and so we're focused on Kabul, and as you mentioned, today's news, of course, brings Kabul into the spotlight. But Kandahar is where Afghanistan was founded as a nation. It's where every single ruler of Afghanistan has come from, including the current one. And it's also, it was the capital of Afghanistan under the Taliban. So it's really no surprise that this armed, whatever you want to call it, opposition has been focusing on the south. It makes a lot of sense historically and culturally and symbolically.
But with a fair amount of success last month, the Taliban was able to free hundreds of its fighters during a raid on a prison located near Kandahar.
Located in town, right on the western edge of town. As a matter of fact, the escaping Taliban and other criminals who got out literally escaped directly through the neighborhood that one of my cooperative members lives in. So I wasn't there at the time, but I did get a blow-by-blow on the telephone from him. That was not a very pleasant night or two.
They just blew a hole in the wall the way they do in the Westerns.
Yes, yes, exactly. And what was really interesting, the initial reporting about that jailbreak pointed out how coordinated it was, because it was actually a simultaneous attack on the front and the back of this prison building. But I think it was even more organized than that, because just about 3 days later came the attack on the most strategic district in the entire South, practically. And what and that had been brewing for a while. I had been expecting it to come this spring. But for it to come that close on the heels of the jailbreak implies to me that the jailbreak, in a way, was a diversion, because those prisoners escaped toward the west and south of town, and all of the NATO troops, I don't know if you remember the reporting, were kind of beating the bushes looking for these criminals and Taliban and things like that. And then the attack on that district, that the district I mentioned, is to the north.
Mm-hmm.
So basically the international and Afghan military forces had their backs turned when this very key district got attacked just a few days after the jailbreak.
You once called the Taliban a shadow government.
Hmm.
What did you mean by that, and is it still true?
Well, Again, I don't mean a shadow government for the entire country. I don't mean there's a shadow defense minister and you know, foreign minister and things like that. But what I have been witnessing in the last, I would say, 6 months and more, is that even in areas that are nominally under the control of the Karzai government, when individual villagers and ordinary people need to make decisions that impact their everyday lives, they will actually go and consult the Taliban or request permission from the Taliban.
Why is that?
Because they're afraid. Because the Taliban, what they're doing is really impacting people's psychology while not spilling all that much blood. And this is something that doesn't really show up on the radars, because we have a tendency to count, as you know, the NPR report that we kicked off with did, we count bodies, you know, and bodies certainly are meaningful in terms of the impact on people's psychology, but you don't necessarily need a lot of bodies in order to cow people, because this is a population that's, you know, it's lived through 30 years of traumatic conflict. And so what I've been hearing is things like, one village I know, again, in an area that's fairly densely covered with Canadian NATO troops and Afghan armed forces, nevertheless, this village wanted to clean out its irrigation channel that distributes water to the whole village, and they wanted to use a bulldozer. And they were afraid the Taliban in the area would come and attack the bulldozer. So they actually made a meet with the local Taliban. They sent a delegation of village elders and the whole thing, and they negotiated. They said, look, we want to work on our irrigation channel. Please don't attack our bulldozer. And the Taliban said, okay, that's fine if it's a private bulldozer. But don't let it be, you know, a reconstruction project provided by the foreigners. You can't even use a free bulldozer provided by the government. You have to use a privately owned bulldozer. And when the elders agreed, the Taliban wrote them out a safe conduct. Even so, the villagers were a little bit concerned, as was, as you can imagine, the guy who owned the bulldozer. So they ended up doing it by hand.
Are the Taliban also being helped by incidents like the one yesterday where Haji Amir Shah Gul, the chief government official in the in a district of the Nangarhar province, said villagers reported that between 30 and 35 men, women, and children walking in a group toward a wedding were killed and up to 10 others wounded in a bombing that the United States-led coalition says did not happen. Actually, they said it killed just several militants. There seem to have been any number of incidents where locals have claimed that innocent civilians have been killed, and NATO and U.S. coalition people have said that they were militants, and that seems to have been working against hearts and minds approaches.
Very much so. I can't speak to the details of that incident because in Afghanistan everything is local, and I wouldn't hazard a guess as to who actually got killed, but I've seen examples like this. Even small-scale ones are tremendously important. Kandahar is an area there are three different countries that have sort of lead nation status for different provinces in the Afghan south. And they all get to their various areas of operation through Kandahar. So what we've been seeing a lot of is not so much these bombing incidents, but rather if a convoy either hits an improvised bomb or feels threatened by the way a car is approaching or something like that, they've tended to be a little bit trigger happy in the past. And again, this is an incident or the type of incident that touched us directly when a NATO armored vehicle hit an improvised bomb and the turret gunner started firing and killed the sharecropper of one of my cooperative members and his 7-year-old son. And I'm telling you, my cooperative member works with me, an American female, so he is not, you know, this is not a guy who is anti-Western in any way, shape, or form. But he was saying, you know, it's not just that the people got killed, but the army responsible never even went to investigate it. And he was saying, how can we possibly think that this isn't deliberate? Or another case, a similar case, where a truck driver was killed. His brother, first of all, inherits the victim's wife and her children that he now has to support, and there was no offer of compensation or anything like that. And in that case, at least 1,000 people attended this guy's funeral, and you started hearing some of the sort of almost anti-Soviet rhetoric that you really haven't been hearing in Afghanistan in spite of the international presence. So I think that, you know, of course it's true that war is war and there is going to be damage to property and to people. However, number one, it needs to really be kept to a minimum. And property, too. These people are so impoverished. I was recently speaking to some U.S. military and just asked them if they were driving in a convoy through a village and clipped, let's say, a retaining wall around an orchard and pulled down part of the wall, would they even refer to that? Would they even mention it in their kind of roundup at the end of the convoy? And most of the people said, no, we wouldn't even mention that. And I'm thinking, this really makes a difference to the guy whose orchard it is, you know. And so you use the word hearts and minds, and we hear it again and again, but I do have the feeling that there's an underestimation of the degree to which this is a population that is still, you know, kind of ours to lose, if you see what I mean. They can all be allies, just about, or they can all turn into the opposition.
Well,
and it really depends on how we behave.
The issue of civilian casualties has caused friction between the Karzai government and the U.S. and NATO troops in the past, but hasn't it also weakened the standing of Karzai in the eyes of the Afghan public?
Yeah, absolutely, because Karzai is very much seen as a product of the West. So as much as we like to call this the democratically elected government of Afghanistan, you could have fooled the Afghans. I mean, they basically feel like this whole government is something that we put in place. And that means that what we do wrong gets blamed on the government, and what the government does wrong is blamed on us, we meaning the international community.
In April, there was that assassination attempt targeting President Karzai, carried out during a military parade marking the anniversary of the defeat of the Russian army. Slightly ironic. Would the country sink into chaos if he were assassinated?
You know, it's a really interesting question because the degree of unpopularity of President Karzai is quite difficult to overestimate. In other words, he is profoundly and widely unpopular. However, even among people who gripe about him all the time, when that happened, you know, almost everyone I know was saying, oh, thank God he didn't get killed. So there is a certain degree of a slightly paradoxical attitude on the part of Afghans. I think that, you know, were there a transition, to a different leadership in Kabul, it would be much better that took place as the result of democratic processes rather than as a result of an assassination.
I'm talking with Sarah Chase, who was for many years an NPR reporter and now runs a cooperative called Argand out of Kandahar and is also the author of the recent book, The Punishment of Virtue, Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Sarah Chase, who is based in Kandahar, although I'm talking to her right now in Paris. She's written a book called The Punishment of Virtue Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban. We'll get to why you're in Paris in a moment. But following the line of questioning so far, is there any evidence that the Karzai government would be willing to negotiate with the Taliban?
Well, my understanding is that President Karzai's older brother, for whom I used to work, has been traveling back and forth to Quetta, Pakistan, quite a bit recently, and that's where the leadership of the southern of the Taliban that are really focusing on the south is located. So I think there's actually quite a bit of evidence that a number of people are interested in negotiating, both within the Karzai government and, in particular, amongst some of the non-U.S. NATO partners, like Great Britain in particular. And to some extent, there have been some noises coming out of Washington to the effect that this would not be anathema. I find it a really curious approach because I don't see that it's really addressing either of the main two problems that has that have led to the situation that we're currently in. One of which is the policies of the Pakistani government, which has been actively orchestrating this so-called insurgency, and the other is the really terrible behavior of the Afghan government. Quite frankly, I can't really speak to President Karzai himself, but he is certainly presiding over a government that's become basically a free-for-all. And I think that the ordinary Afghan citizens should not be blamed for withholding their allegiance from a government that is treating them as badly as this one is. And it just means totally systematic and endemic corruption at every single level of government. And that means extortion. I mean, it's not, corruption is one of these words that, you know, hides a multitude of sins. And I think we forget that corruption isn't, you know, a kind of white collar crime. It's something that actually impacts ordinary people on a daily basis. And so it's the increasing disaffection of the Afghan population with the behavior of this government that has caused them to turn more and more of a blind eye on Taliban activity. So I don't see how negotiating with the Taliban solves either of those problems.
And there's a third issue there, and what would the end result be? But what should we address first, Pakistan or the corruption of the government? Because Pakistan has a new prime minister, Yousef Raza Gilani, and I wonder whether that might suggest some kind of change in policy.
I think it could. You know, I've been very interested from my remove and very excited by what's been going on in Pakistan. It does look like there's been a genuine democratic kind of upheaval in that country, one that I would have loved to have seen Washington support a bit more than wholeheartedly than it did, you know. And so I think given this new orientation, there's a real opportunity. However, for the moment, you know, it's funny because the Musharraf government of Pakistan was really playing a double game, was supposedly cracking down on the Taliban while secretly orchestrating them, basically. This government is saying we don't want to crack down as militarily as Musharraf was doing, and so has been reaching some agreements and things like that. I think the real issue doesn't have to do with, you know, raiding the tribal areas or anything like that. It has to do with arresting. It's really a law enforcement issue, not a military issue. The leadership of the Taliban movement, which is largely sitting pretty in provincial capitals. So I think there is something this government can do very significantly that may not, you know, raise the ire of its own population by being seen to be military action against Pakistani citizens.
Now, what about the corruption? Why has Karzai allowed it to get out of hand? He had to have been aware of the fact that it would cause problems. And why hasn't the United States played a greater role in preventing this sort of thing from happening?
On the Karzai side, I really can't answer that. It's one of the big conundrums that has puzzled and disillusioned me.
Because you knew. You've had something of a friendship with
Hamid Karzai. I did. I mean, not as much with President Karzai himself, but with two of his brothers, for one of whom I worked and another of whom I was very close to. And I was really inspired by these people, and I'm just gobsmacked as to how this corruption has gotten out of control and how it, you know, repeatedly the appointments process, it's not like, you know, he got locked into something in the beginning, but once he gained his feet, he could, you know, remove some of the worst offenders. No, on the contrary, he keeps moving them around and replacing them in positions of more and more power. And, you know, so on that one, I really can't, I can't honestly answer you because I've been, you know, scratching my own head about it. But The second part of your question may hold the key, which is that the international community has really not been interested in corruption, in particular the United States. And I kept on hearing for the first several years that I was in Afghanistan that, you know, oh, we'll worry about governance later. First, we have to focus on security. And my answer to that was, you're never going to get security if people are unhappy with their government, that it's, in fact, the poor governance that is at the root of the security problem.
In fact, the Taliban were a success in the first instance because of the public's unhappiness with the situation post the forcing the Soviet Union to leave.
Precisely.
All of that they came in to as a stabilizing force, and now that's what they're offering themselves
again. Exactly. Thank you. Would you please, I would love it if you could design U.S. policy toward Afghanistan, because
If I'm asked to run, I will refuse.
You'll design the policy from the comfort of your studio. Is that it?
but that always struck me as an obvious given.
It is. It is. And I just do not understand why that simple lesson in history has really not dawned on anyone. And it's only now that you're starting to get some serious lip service being paid to corruption. But it's still only lip service. And I experienced this because I have a certain number of interactions with international officials, both civilian and military. And this is the issue I raise all the time. And it is amazing. You will sit there and listen to people spend 15 minutes telling you why it's somebody else's job. And because I talk to all of them, I keep getting run all the way around the circle. It's always somebody else's job, and just nobody wants to take this on. And to me, it's crystal clear that this problem is not going to get solved until governance is addressed. And what's interesting about this is that it answers a question I'm often asked about democracy. You know, are we right to be imposing democracy on people who just aren't ready for it or don't want it or whatever? And I say, now, so wait a second. What is it that we've brought to Afghanistan? We've brought endemic corruption, stolen elections, brutality and occasionally torture. Is this really what we mean by democracy?
I'm talking with Sarah Chase, who has been living in Kandahar for how long so far, Sarah?
A little more than 6.5 years.
And has been running a cooperative called Argand, which involves local farmers and other people making soaps and other artisanal products. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I got the feeling that you were saying that you can't run your business without paying bribes or in some way or another running into the kind of corruption that we've been talking about. Even a business like yours?
I can, because basically I am seen in Kandahar as this walking minefield. Nobody quite knows what to do with me because I might go off. However, we've definitely run into these issues of corruption. It's just that if I go, for example, I mean, pretty much any time we need to interact with the government, we encounter an attempt to shake us down. For example, bringing things, we do import two of our products, two oils that we use, coconut oil and palm oil. And, you know, I know the cross-border tribes. I can smuggle anything I want into Afghanistan, but I decided to do this like a good girl and have it sent to customs. And there's this whole rigmarole in customs where, you know, oh, you're only part of a truck, and so, you know, they just divide up the amount of duty on the whole truck and tell you that you're a third. They don't list it out as to what products you have and what the duties are on those specific products. I mean, it's insane. Then when I didn't want to pay that, then I'm told that our coconut oil needs to be sent to Kabul for health standard testing, although it's not being used for food. You know, all these sort of bureaucratic hang-ups become excuses to extract money. And then, as I say, because I'm a foreigner and nobody dares throw me in jail, I can stamp my foot and get through these things, but ordinary Afghans can't. It's crazy.
Have you had any knowing contact with the Taliban?
No. No, but my cooperative members often do, in that increasingly locals are beginning to join the fight. And so, you know, you're sitting at dinner or after dinner drinking tea, shooting the breeze with your, you know, relatives, neighbors, and there may be one or two of them who are involved. And so everyone is very much, on tenterhooks, because, you know, nobody really knows anymore who their friends are and who their enemies are.
And you've said that people get drawn into this through blood feuds.
Some extent, in that, I mean, blood feud is a bit of a strong way of putting it, but it goes back to your question a few minutes ago about civilian casualties. If my brother gets killed, let's say in a drive-by shooting by a British convoy, and nobody comes back to ask me, you know, was he involved in, you know, was he a Talib or not? Do I need compensation? What's going to happen to his widow? Well, then I may, you know, feel that I need to extract some kind of vengeance. And I think, you know, there is a level of anger that's building up. People understand mistakes. They really do. But it depends on how you handle that mistake, with what degree of contrition you respond to your own commission of a mistake, number one. And number two, how often those mistakes happen. In other words, a lot of people say, yeah, well, the first year it was a mistake, but 6 years later, why are they still making these mistakes? So that does occasionally push people into the whatever you want to call it, armed opposition. Another interesting story that happened to us was the friend of somebody that I know well was driving a money convoy up to a town to the northwest of Kandahar and got robbed. $60,000. He was transporting funds. $60,000 got robbed. He went to the police. The police said, oh, we can't operate in that area at all. That's a Taliban area. So he said, okay. He goes to the Taliban, and he made up an identity, said he was from, you know, a different district and from a different tribe, a sympathetic tribe, and they basically put their arms around him and said, okay, you're our brother. We know your tribe. We know your, you know, your area. And they eventually caught the thief.
I hear you just returned from Okinawa, where you were working in educational sessions for the Marines.
Yeah.
What's that all about?
Well, you know, there's one Marine Expeditionary Unit currently deployed to the South, supposedly as a temporary thing. The people who invited me are actually a group that will be going in to be embedded trainers with the Afghan National Army. So they were looking for some, you know, on-the-ground cultural training and briefing, essentially. And then before it was over, every unit on the island had asked me to talk to them, because I think there is a sense within the Marine Corps that they may be drawing down somewhat from Iraq in the next, I would say, year or two, and likely to be increasing their involvement in Afghanistan. So there was a lot of interest. I would say that everything we've been discussing in this conversation are issues that they really need to think about. It doesn't come naturally to the United States Marines to be a machine that fixes things rather than a machine that breaks them.
Well, in your book, The Punishment of Virtue, you were at times frustrated that your message wasn't getting heard, and maybe it's getting heard a bit, but has there been any response from the U.S. State Department or from delegates on the ground to your action plan for Afghanistan?
None whatsoever. That was something that I kind of distributed more or less privately. But I have distributed it to some people in, staff members in the U.S. Senate. No response, really. It's pretty comprehensive. I mean, I think this is fixable, but I really still do think that it's theoretically fixable. But I think it will need some really concerted action and a change of direction. And just back to the Marines for a moment, what I want to say is that, they have some ground to make up, but I was quite interested at being invited. And this was a cold call based on, you know, it was a lieutenant colonel who read my book, which was not on their official reading list. And he said, you know what, I'd like to get some input from outside the kind of mainstream military channels. And he was able to sell that to his commanding general. So I do get the feeling in, I would say, about the last 6 months that U.S. thinking may be starting to, or I would say U.S. decision makers, both military and civilian, may be starting to think outside the box that we've been imprisoned in for the last 6 years.
Sarah, we have just a minute to go, but I mentioned you're in Paris now. What are you doing there, and are you planning to return to Kandahar soon?
Oh, yeah. I'll be on a flight to Kandahar in the next several days. When I'm not there, I'm here. I have a little this is in military terms, my mission support site. But on top of the Marines, I also do quite a bit of training for NATO officers deploying to, in particular, southern Afghanistan. And they've got, NATO has a really good system of working civilians into their training process. And so that's been an education for me, I think, as well as for the NATO officers.
We have a link to your organization, your cooperative, ARGAND, posted on our show page at WNYC.org. By the way, ARGAND is spelled ARGHAND, like ARG hand, I guess. Go to our show page at WNYC.org if you want to find out more about Sarah Chase Soap Cooperative. There's also the book, The Punishment of Virtue, Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban. And, of course, her visits to this show. Sarah, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, even though your message isn't always all that pleasant.
Exactly. Has not varied, but it's always similarly a delight and a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you so much for having me.